Next up is Friendly Fire, A Voice for Veterans with Don Kimble, who is himself an Air Force veteran. Friendly Fire is broadcast every Friday at 10 a.m. right here on KURU 89.1 FM, Silver City, New Mexico, and on the web at gmcr.org.
This is Friendly Fire, A Voice for Veterans. The military often recruits America's best and brightest. What happens when they blow the whistle on war crimes ordered by unaccountable leaders using drone technology? With us today are United States Air Force veterans Lisa Ling and Sean Westmoreland. Join us as we walk a mile in these two whistleblowers' shoes. Stay tuned. And welcome to Friendly Fire, A Voice for Veterans. I'm your host, Don Kimble. Pleasure to have you along with us today. We are recording from a remote location we call the Sacred Feather Studios, and we're very happy to be on KURU-FM 89.1 Silver City, New Mexico, or gmcr.org. And now let's go to our previously recorded interview with Sean Westmoreland and Lisa Ling.
With us, we're very proud and pleased to have, calling from Mexico, Sean Westmoreland. He is a former drone technician in the United States Air Force and was featured in the book Hellfire from Paradise Ranch on the Front Lines of Drone Warfare by Yosiba Zuleika. And also joining us today from the Bay Area, Lisa Ling. Lisa, thanks for coming back on Friendly Fire. And Lisa was also in the drone program and was featured in the movie National Bird. Both Sean and Lisa are whistleblowers who have let the public know exactly how the drone program operates as much as they can, because, of course, most of the information, majority of the information is classified, which they cannot tell us, but they can tell us about some of the results of the drone program. Their thoughts on that, and also the work that they've done, technical work that they've done, and the future of drone warfare, what that looks like. And it's not a pretty picture. It's a very secretive, well-funded, and extremely dangerous program. Guys, thanks so much for coming on Friendly Fire.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yes, thanks for having us.
Lisa, let's start with you and the movie National Bird, Sonia Kennebec's documentary that's been out for a few years now, which was one of the biggest revelations about the drone program ever. You were quoted as saying, when you work for the drone program, you lost part of your humanity. You worked very closely with people when you were in the Army as a surgical nurse. You saw how people could be injured, what some battlefield injuries looked like, and then you went to the Air Force, and you know full well what the bombs, the Hellfire missiles that are fired from these drones do to a person physically. You've also traveled to Afghanistan, I believe, after your military service to network with the folks over there. Tell us a little bit about that, please.
So basically, in a nutshell, I mean, I think this whole... the whole drone program, the whole, like, talking about artificial intelligence, talking about, all of the things that they do to sell technology to solve human problems, removes the humanity from the conversation. It removes, you know, any emotional connection. I mean, if our only connection to all of the wars that we're participating in is a keyboard and a monitor, then why stop? I mean, the general public doesn't get to see any, you know, I mean, during Vietnam, there was a lot of things that the public got to see that angered them about the Vietnam War. Well, today, those things aren't shown to the public. It's touted as being clean, as if war could ever be clean. It's touted as being precise, as if there's any difference in the way that you aim a weapon that's conventional with a laser. Yeah, it's precise, but the data and the collection of information on people that don't even record their birthdays or even know them. I mean, you're talking about a bunch of information that's collected to target people all the humanities just been taken out of the entire conversation, and it's wrong.
When you went into the Air Force, Lisa, did you go into the drone program?
I started out as a nurse, and I was kind of a technical person. Wherever I went, I did technical work because I knew how. And then eventually I went over to the Air Force, and I was working in what's called combat communications, which is basically facilitating the infrastructure necessary for people to be able to talk to each other during combat. I mean, it's just what it sounds, combat communications. And then the unit changed while I was in it.
And do you come from a military family at all, Lisa?
My father was in the military, but he got out of the military before I was born.
Well, let's bring Sean in now. Sean, how did you decide on the Air Force instead of the Army? Because as most people will recognize your last name, your grandfather was a general in the United States Army. How did you decide on the Air Force instead of the Army? And was there pressure put on you by the family to go in the Army? Or
He was actually a cousin of my grandfather, not my grandfather. But I chose to go in the Air Force because my father was in the Air Force.
Okay.
And I wanted to work in something technical because I had a computer background. And I was interested in, you know, working with satellites and working with, you know, networks, radios, things of that nature. So I went in as a RF SATCOM technician. My first duty station was in Osan Air Base, and we maintained the air picture over the Korean Peninsula. And then I went to Spengdahlem, Germany. I was part of the 606 Air Control Squadron, and our job there was to be, we were an expeditionary unit. Our purpose was to more or less be able to go anywhere in the world within, you know, a couple of weeks and set up the air picture and data links and satellite communications, whatever is needed for operators in theater to commanders and operators at the distant end there. And we were, you know, working with several different units at the time. I was going in between different units on base. And in the meantime, setting up our site, which took a few weeks, we were responsible for communications for, you know, not just drones, but also conventional aircraft. A lot of the information that went over our system was targeting information, geolocation, imagery, voice. While I was there, I mean, you know, I'd seen videos of airstrikes, and some of them, you know, occurred through the system that we set up. Of course, food for thought, you know, what's the impact of your work and your life and what you're doing? Understanding that we set up something that was more or less over the entirety of Afghanistan, assisting every airstrike that happened in Afghanistan. And then being told one day, hey, we're killing bad guys now, and having leadership brag about how they're going to use it for promotional purposes. You know, you're just kind of like, well, there's something wrong here. You know, there's certainly like a disregard, or just like nobody's making the connection that like these numbers are human beings. It never sat well with me. And of course, I, you know, did some traveling afterwards and decided to study international relations. I mean, of course, you know, studying international relations and seeing the ideas and the theories and the, you know, just the type of background information that helps lead people into making decisions to send people to war, like me and like anybody who's, you know, in the military. You know, it's not that impressive. Like, it doesn't, I mean, it's kind of depressing, to be honest with you. I mean, it's, from my perspective, you know, like you, I mean, do what you do, you can be for or against the war, doesn't matter. But I mean, at the end of the day, like, I mean, you're doing something that irrevocably changes the world and changes people's lives. And to sit there and pretend that that makes you happy and sit there and pretend that, you know, like you're okay with that is, you know, not necessary to being a good soldier or being a good patriot. Like, I think you need to, there's a part of American culture with, in that regard, that there's an entire like lack of, I guess, perspective, but also just there's not a real culture around, you know, reflecting on the pain that you've like you've inflicted. And it's an, I think it's important to understand that, but also to pursue that darkness to its, you know, ultimate conclusion, because, you know, at the end of the day, you're the only one that you and other people who participate in that are the only ones that really were exposed to that and can come back with insights and, you know, hopefully inform policymakers one day, hopefully inform people to, you know, make better decisions with, you know, with regard to these wars that we've been involved in for over 20 years.
Whistleblowers are so very important to the democratic process, and you guys are a prime example of that. Sean, talk a little bit about the diffusion of accountability that's mentioned in the book Hellfire from Paradise Ranch, that, you know, allows, you know, people are killed and it allows like, sort of an illusion that nobody's responsible for them. It's kind of a, just off in the atmosphere, so to speak, and nobody really takes responsibility.
I think that's a key feature of the drone program, in a sense, is that there's so many different responsibilities. You have analysts basically looking at different pieces of information. You have different decision makers within the chain. I mean, even down at the technical level, you can have like a piece of equipment that's not calibrated correctly that could ultimately, you know, cause the weapon or the analysis to be off. I mean, equipment or program, whatever. And that's not something that's really looked at either. But I mean, if you're the one who's in charge of calibrating that piece of equipment and it's off and somebody dies because of that, well, I mean, you're responsible. You know, we're moving into a world where, you know, you don't just have people writing codes for things to be done, but you have programs writing codes themselves in order to like automate the process, because ultimately you're going through so much information at any given time that it's hard to distill that in a readable, like palpable format for analysts. So that's something, you know, it's not just the technology itself, but how people interface with the technologies that you're working with and how different decisions are parsed between, you know, different people within that, you know, that framework that ultimately leads to a strike, how the policies are implemented and what the framework around what, you know, an acceptable like course of action is for, you know, this program, you know, what's the leeway there? What can they get away with? Who's ultimately authorizing everything? I mean, under Trump, I mean, he basically just gave it to the CIA. The Obama administration, it was pretty, I would say, a lot of power was in the executive. So it was just given aside.
You're talking about the Terror Tuesdays where they would decide, Obama would meet with the generals and decide who was going to be killed by a drone strike.
Right.
Pretty bad stuff. We met in 2016, Sean, when you spoke to an audience at the University of Nevada at Las Vegas and a drone conference with other people that were also experts in the drone program. And, you know, that was the same year, ironically, that Obama received the Nobel Peace Prize when he had accelerated the drone program from Bush 43, and then Trump has accelerated it. And we don't know where Biden stands on that, but you know, certainly that president that's involved in a drone assassination program with becoming judge, jury, and executioner to be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize is a very strange world to live in, is it not?
Well, I mean, when you consider Alfred Nobel was the inventor of dynamite, I mean, like, I don't know right. What the value of that prize is anyways. But yeah, I mean, sure, he's done some good things, but there's also just a lot. And I mean, the position of the presidency, you're more or less a big ship with a tiny rudder. Like, you have to, you know, you go with the flow in some respects, and particularly when it involves military adventurism. I mean, you're either for it and everybody praises you for it, or you're against it and they call you a weak leader. So, you know, it's just it's a systemic issue more than any one individual, I would say. But I mean, I think I think Lisa has a keener insight into, you know, like how systemic this is than maybe I do on a technical level.
So Lisa, how did you get approached, and how did you feel when Director Sonia Kennebec came to you to ask you to talk about the drone program for the movie National Bird?
Skeptical, because I didn't want I believe it's an issue in the activist community, and it's an issue of long-term planning. It's an issue of like having clear, concise goals. And there's been a lot of, in my opinion, really great activist movies out that have never done anything. There's been no change or no... So I didn't just want to have a movie, but the only people I know who've seen those quote-unquote activist movies are the choir, right? The people who would go see a film like that. There's lots of them, and to my way of thinking, they're really great movies that I could never talk some members of my family into going to see, that I could never have presented at a university, that I could never really, you know, do anything with. So I was very skeptical. I didn't want it to be a quote-unquote activist film. I really wanted to, if I was going to be in any film, I wanted it to be done by a real investigative journalist. And so, as Sonia has said before, I was the longest one it took to convince to be in the film. And we had long discussions. She drove to where I lived, and, you know, we took a long walk and discussed it. And when I realized, you know, that she really had done her homework. I mean, she came to me with a ream of documentation that said, hey, I was curious about this, and I really investigated the topic. And that's one of Sonia's superpowers that very few people know about. The investigative process that she goes through before she attacks anything to put on screen is pretty intense. It's pretty incredible. And so once I had found out that she had really done her homework. I mean, there are books out there people wrote about drones that really, there was nothing out in the open, and nobody wanted to talk to people who actually worked in the drone program in any way that was effective. In fact, that's still the case today. There's a lot of dronies, you know, like about the protests that happen outside of bases where people really want to talk to somebody in the drone program. Well, my experience with that was they wouldn't let us go out that gate where the activists were. They didn't want us to accidentally say something, so they wouldn't let us go. We had to go around and drive like an extra 45 minutes to an hour to get home at the end of a day, at the end of a really long shift. So what really did that? And then the other thing was, is that they put coffins out there and said, oh, you're baby killers. And, you know, if you want to talk to us, that's really not a great approach. That kind of thing has been going on and on and on for, you know, for a good long time. And these discussions have been had for a good long time. And really, the people who can get other people to come out and talk are the people who have a shared experience and the people who have, you know, a shared disdain for perhaps what they did.
Sonia has since come out with another documentary called USA versus Reality Winner. And you are very much involved with Reality's situation. And do you want to tell the listeners a little bit about who Reality Winner is and where she is right now and what you're doing? You and Sean are both in the Whistleblower Protection Network and advocating for whistleblowers who are either in prison or maybe going to prison. You know, people don't realize, one, how devastating the drone program is, how it actually makes America less safe because we are indiscriminately killing people in weddings and funerals, Of course, by mistake, not by design, but the deaths are still happening. I think, Sean, you mentioned in the book, Hellfire from Paradise Ranch, a number of 395, why anybody would go to you and give you that number is kind of beyond me. But Lisa, this new movie about reality, tell us a little bit about reality and then about the new documentary, please.
So basically, Reality Winner is in federal prison right now. They call it a medical facility, but, and I'm sure there's a medical facility there, but that doesn't mean that, it's very easy to partake in medical care in any federal penal institution. She actually has the longest sentence of any civilian whistleblower who has come out with national defense information. She pled out, and basically her story, it's intense. She got charged with the Espionage Act, right? Which is insane, because what she put out was that there were people trying to attack the 2016 electoral process by sending phishing emails to different companies that were assisting with the votes across, I don't even think it's still known how many of the 54 states and territories where this was occurring. And let's start by saying that the official thing that happens when there's a phishing attack, or especially a spear phishing attack, and that's phishing, not, salmon fishing or something, right?
Right.
A lot of people don't know the technical terms. And so basically what that is sending a fake email out to get you to click on a link or make phone call. And a lot of people will recursively, because, hey, it looks like my bank, it looks like my institution, it looks like my university, click before thinking, or call before thinking. And in order to mitigate that risk to any network, what happens is, and you've seen it from your bank, you've seen it from your schools or colleges or whatever, where they send you an email that warns you, that says, hey, there's a phishing attack happening. Don't click any links if they come from this individual or this institution. Right. Believe it or not, as this was happening right before the 2016 election, nobody told the people who are charged with protecting the electoral process. So I guess the FBI was investigating it, and they never told the officials who needed to know. Never.
And yet reality
and
is also...
Reality Winner... Yeah, Reality Winner sees this thing coming across her computer, clicks it, reads it, and realizes, holy crap, this is our most foundational democratic process. It's being attacked, and nobody's saying a word about it. And so she mails it to a news organization, and very much like Edward Snowden did, news organizations, they're well-versed at picking up a leak or picking up news and putting it out to the public, and they're very conscientious. Basically, she was taking something from within the country and telling the people who needed to know in the country, which is not spying by any long stretch of the imagination, and yet she was charged as a spy. That's insane in my worldview.
In reality, continues to sit in the Carswell Federal Medical Center, serving out the remainder of a 63-month term for releasing that document when she went to work for an NSA contractor after she was in the Air Force. And now there is another drony, I guess you guys call it, who is facing similar charges under the 1917 Espionage Act, who was also featured in the movie National Bird along with you, Lisa, and that's Dan Hale.
Yeah, that's Daniel Hale, and yes, he's looking at sentencing, and he hasn't been sentenced yet. Yeah. And basically what these people are talking about is, obviously Sean and I need to be excruciatingly careful not to disclose any information that, that we got from working in our positions, which we haven't done. All of the information that we've disclosed is publicly available, or on one of our awards that's meant to be hung on the wall, or on our DD-214, or on any one of those documents that are not quote-unquote classified.
Yeah, and let's be clear, everybody, you, Sean, Reality, and I believe Daniel, but I'm not sure about that, were all honorably discharged from serving in the United States Air Force.
Yeah, Reality Included was also involved with the drone program.
Reality was a translator for the drone program, speaks three foreign languages, and perhaps has some PTSD, as a lot of people that have been in the program experience. Sean, do you want to talk a little bit about your experiences with post-traumatic stress disorder?
Yeah, I would say a huge component of it is, I would say, moral injury, because, I mean, you're not really at much risk to yourself, and yet you're, you know, involved in harming other people. You know, that's, from my perspective, it's kind of one of those gnawing things that just never really goes away. And, you know, having a number like I had, like Lisa had, like a lot of people who've been involved have, it's when you acknowledge that every single one of those numbers was a human being, that they all had families, that, you know, there's a lot of pain that you brought into this world. It's really hard to sit with that. It's hard to really live with it. And, you know, I mean, it's a profound sadness. You know, it kind of leaches into every single one of your relationships with people. I mean, it's hard to connect with people because it's like, why are you sad? Well, most people are like, oh, you know, the dog chewed up my favorite book or something. It's like, yeah, how do you even have a conversation like that with somebody who hasn't, you know, been, you know, involved with that, or even in the peace community, like trying to sit there and have a, you know, public discussion with somebody who has spent the bulk of their life on, you know, on the other side of the fence, so to speak, you know, kind of railing against the machine or whatever, and they have no way of understanding why you would even put yourself through that, like, or even, you know, be involved in that, like, as a, you know, sentient human being. I guess they assume something's wrong with you, you know, and then the justifications you give them of just like, well, you know, I was 18, I didn't really know what I was getting involved with, or I didn't know that we were going to be doing this. I mean, like, your brain's still developing at 18. You're not really, like, I mean, you think you're doing technical work, or you think, you know, like, you're not going to be over there shooting somebody, or even if you are, you're just, you know, assume that there's smarter people out there who have better reasons than you do. You know, my country wouldn't send me to a war that justified, like, you know, they're not going to do that to the, you know, youth of America, I guess. I mean, there's a profound disillusionment that people like me, and I think a lot of people in the About Face, Veterans for Peace community have. I mean, people who aren't even in the community, just because they don't necessarily agree with all of its tenets, or, you know, have personality conflicts with people. That's an entirely different world from, I guess, the people who've always been in the peace community, always trying to advocate for the right thing. And, you know, God bless those people, you know. It's it is sometimes hard to have conversations with them, though. It's hard to listen to what their opinions are, like, why didn't you just get a job at McDonald's or whatever, you know, like, that's you know, if they think we haven't thought about that, you know, that's it's really easy to talk in retrospect. But you know, I think, like, I've had, you know, many, many years, I think, of getting to this point. And it started out with just, like, denying it and denying my emotions and, you know, punching walls and getting in fights over nothing. Like, just because, you know, it's you just have a lot of emotion that you haven't processed.
You are listening to Friendly Fire on KURU 89.1 FM, Silver City, New Mexico, and on the web at gmcr.org. And now, back to Friendly Fire with Don Kimball.
And, you know, as you start kind of, like, facing your demons, or at least looking into the void, I guess, you know, and realizing, okay, you know, this isn't a fantasy, you know, this isn't like, I played a video game and, you know, got 200 kills or whatever. This is like, these are people, you know, living their lives. Their lives aren't worth any less than mine. Like after traveling and seeing, you know, how people live and like how generally people all kind of want the same things. You know, their cultures may be different, but they're not like prohibitive to my human experience. You know, it's we were just blessed with different tickets in the geographic lottery, I guess. But yeah.
I don't mind talking about, you talk about moral injury and it's very, so straight up front, it's very simple. You get a moral injury from consummating an immoral act and the pain is deep. And yeah, when Sean was talking about having numbers, it's numbers that we carry for the human beings whose lives we've inextricably altered. And there's a lot of people in the peace community who have judgment against people who have worn the uniform without ever asking, what's our story? How did that happen? Just judgment because they didn't make that quote unquote choice to join the military. And the fact of the matter is that they've also never heard of the poverty draft. Or maybe they have, but unless you've been there, you don't understand it. Unless you've seen it, unless you've walked a mile in, and by principle, they say, if you've walked a mile in somebody else's shoes, right? Then you understand them, except where this is concerned, except where war and peace is concerned, because they're very inflammable issues. And the fact of the matter is that when there's a lot of people out there right now, there's communities of color who are sitting up front and they are defending their communities from an inordinate amount of surveillance that doesn't happen where I live in white world. It doesn't. There are people, there are indigenous communities that are, that are stepping up and fighting for the same issues in their communities. And that's where I learn. Those are the people I talk to. I mean, there's a bunch of privileged people trying to sit here and go up against drone warfare, and they don't necessarily have the understanding of what it's like to be in a lower socioeconomic level or in any of the oppressed communities to have the surveillance happen. And I wish that those people would take a step out of their comfort zone, walk into these communities and speak to these activists, the ones that are defending where they freaking live. And just like I wish that when they're trying to go up against the drone program, there's not many of y'all that talk to us, the dronies. There's very few. And I would say that I'm not taking this for getting on a pedestal, but we absolutely know more about the secret world of the drone program than those that have never been in it.
And that's
so
why we
come talk to us.
Yeah, and that's why we've got you here, and I know that you dronies all support each other, and it's very important for you to be able to talk to each other, support each other, and
we also say things like those protests in front of military bases where you call us baby killers are ineffective.
Yeah,
we say that. And y'all don't hear it.
I would say conversely on the other, that's kind of, I would say the lesser heard things that don't really get out to the peace community. Of course, there is the aspect of the moral injury and the, having to face the country that you live in too, that's probably, you've heard a lot more about. The idea of coming back home and being totally disillusioned with the American fantasy
experience.
Yeah. The one that, tries to tell you that we're a force for good around the world and we're, we've experienced otherwise and in really difficult ways. There's different ways of trying to react to that. It's just like, it's kind of like we had to make, moral sacrifices in order for everybody else to live the way they do. And, you kind of stand up on the, the pedestal, like you're like salute the flag, like, you know, stand while you're saluting the flag or saying the anthem, you know, that kind of rhetoric, because it's a defensive thing. It's just like, oh God, you know, I don't want anybody else to, it's.
Or, you know, taking a knee.
Everybody is in, I guess you would say everybody's in a search for meaning or whatever. And a lot of people find their meaning through the military and their military experience. And of course, there's a lot of people who, you know, are hurt by the fact that people, like, you know, will kneel at the flag, or, you know, that they will call out the United States as a colonizing nation, or a nation of, you know, with a history of colonialism. And then, you know, pointing out the fact that it's there's a lot more diversity here with a lot more diverse histories here. You know, and there's that defensiveness, and that's kind of like excused by, I would say, the mainstream public, because they're just like, oh, we need to be better to our guys. You know, like, there's the you know, thank your troops and all that.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you for your service. Yeah, and that's really just, a lot of times it's just lip service. I mean, there's not I'm sure there's a lot of people who are listening that probably have had experiences like that, and it kind of irks them, because, like, first off, you don't even know what we did, and second off, like, what are you even thanking us for? Like, what are you, like, what in your mind makes you think that you need to, like, thank us, or that this does anything? Like, all the while, we've had a war that's going on for over 20 years, and there's people coming back, not just, like, there's more people that have killed themselves than have died in Iraq or Afghanistan. I mean, nobody, that's not really being talked about, you know.
You're talking about veteran suicide?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The number averages is around 22 a day.
I think it's more. I think it's more. Well, 22 a day is official, but they're not calculating everything into that.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, they're lying. The government is lying about that, as they're lying about a lot of things. Do you guys feel that you're being watched?
I think everybody's being watched.
If you don't think you're being watched, then you haven't been paying attention.
Right. Well, do you think you're being more watched than, say, you know, the average talk show host?
I don't know. Have we had inconveniences? Yeah, we all have. I mean, I remember talking to, you know, the first drone whistleblower came out, Brandon. I remember talking to him, and he'd be like, damn, I remember my password. And I'd be, in my own mind, being a computer geek, right, thinking, nah, he just forgot his password, or this just isn't right. And then at a later date, I'm like, nah, those inconveniences, they happen. They just do. And so, you know, I mean, but do I sit around thinking about it and being paranoid in that way? I think that we all, and that's the other thing I want to talk about, strategy. Like, what are we pushing back against? Maybe we should be pushing for the news media to document where all of America is being surveilled, where we are starting, you know, like, there's so many times when they say, hey, we don't want to be like China because of the technology and the surveillance and all of that stuff, when in fact we are walking down the same road. I mean, how many times have you watched television lately and seen an advertisement for how to improve your credit score with an online application, and yet don't notice the trajectory that we're going? So, I mean, and I don't think that it's necessary that, like, people be, you know, like, whistleblowers be segregated out. I mean, it's just like people are so proud of being in a protest and getting arrested. I was arrested at a protest. Like, that's a big thing. It solves nothing. And it takes one person out of the field of play for that moment. So maybe we ought to start talking about how we can be activists and not go to jail, like, be disruptive and not go to prison. Or think of, you know, I mean, there's so many misconceptions. Like, a lot of people think that getting rid of the draft was a great idea. I personally don't think that getting rid of the draft was the great idea, because even those people who were trying to avoid the draft had to pay attention that there was war going on. Right now, there are people in this world that do not know how many countries we're at war in.
I just think there's a lot of people in the U.S. who don't know how many wars that, you know, or how many countries we're actively acting aggressively in.
Or extracting in.
I mean, as far as like surveillance, I mean, everybody's having metadata extracted from them. I mean, anytime you see target advertisements, of course, it's not that they're necessarily listening to you. It's that they have like such a comprehensive profile on you that they kind of have an idea of what they think you want in that given moment.
And when you say they, are you talking about Facebook, Sean, or?
Well, I mean, yeah, you have these companies and they're sort of proxy organizations. Like, I mean, of course the government has back doors. I mean, that's been proven. I don't think that's changed.
Since COINTELPRO, right?
Well, I mean, you have COINTELPRO too, but I mean, it's just like you have, I mean, yeah, you have companies like Facebook, Instagram, whatever. They're all collecting information from you for advertisement purposes, but you know, that information is useful for other things too. There's also like,
oh, and just to be clear, let me throw this out there. Just to be clear, people think that if they're not on Facebook, they don't have to worry about Facebook collecting their metadata. But every website that you go to has a Facebook link on it, then they're taking your metadata.
Certainly the surveillance state is growing all the time, as is the drone technology. Sean, do you want to talk a little bit about the new drone technology that is already here as far as it goes with artificial intelligence, which would be an autonomous drone, swarm drones, things of that nature? The technology is really getting frightening, isn't it?
Like you have coders writing code, and then you have codes now writing code. So, I mean, that's kind of where we're headed in that respect, just the root level. But
and that's, sorry, Sean, and that's it for people, that's an artificial intelligence?
I mean, that's a code writing itself. You know, it's like at any given time, like you have, say, a drone flying in the sky that's, you know, I guess, say, autonomously driving itself. Like you have the code which gives the parameters for what this, you know, this object in the sky is supposed to be following, but then of course as it's scanning areas, it would be creating interpretations of that. But I mean, like that's you know, having a robot making decisions at that at the local level is still a little bit of ways off. I mean, what we're really talking about here is like, you've seen things like Amazon Alexa, right? The computing power in an Alexa is not in the Alexa itself. You know, it connects to the internet, which connects to a data center somewhere, and everything's being processed there. So what we're talking about as far as like partially autonomous or autonomous weapons, you know, they're still going to be connected remotely to something somewhere. That's developing at a pace that no one can really foresee. I mean, it's happening all over the world, like in China, the US. When you're talking about like you're seeing the cost of commercial space flight going down because they're developing new rockets that will be reusable. Well, I mean, they're putting up satellites that blanket the globe in Q-band, in the Q-band, you know, which is the same bandwidth used for drones or remotely piloted or, you know, remote weapon systems. And it's drastically increasing the bandwidth that's available. So, I mean, you're like, on the one hand, you're talking about global access to internet. On the other hand, you're talking about global reach for partially autonomous weapon systems.
What command is it that the Air Force runs the drone program with? And is this and this new Space Force that the Air Force is, it's not necessarily the Air Force, but the new Space Force, which is going to be like another branch of the military, are they going to be involved with the drones or is that just satellites?
Can I speak a little bit to that?
Sure. Go ahead.
So basically what we're looking at, there's a bunch of terms that get thrown about when we're talking about these computing devices. Quantum. We're going to have quantum warfare now. Or artificial intelligence, like there's an artificial intelligent thing. Or, you know, accuracy or all of these. I mean, these are all sales tactics to sell you on these ideas of a clean war. So, I mean, like Sean just said, we are a ways off for till actual artificial intelligence, but there is like basically a cloud where things happen, which is basically, I mean, a cloud is nothing more than a bunch of computers with a bunch of, you know, storage devices and that kind of thing. And the transport, which is where Sean knows a lot more than I do, the transport, where you're able to transport that data. The revolution that we're going through right now, as far as technology is concerned, is as vast and all-encompassing as the Industrial Revolution was. And we need to start looking at it like that, because the Industrial Revolution changed the face of war. That's when we started to get planes, when we started to have some distance between us and the area of combat. The technological revolution that we're sitting in right now is going to put us at more distance from quote-unquote combat, right? And that's the goal. And as that occurs, there becomes less and less a reason not to fight in wars. And if we really want to put it, I mean, because we're looking at it right now, we're looking at COVID-19. And one would think that the entire freaking planet would get together in defense of humanity.
One would hope.
But we're not.
No, we're not. And the pharmaceutical companies are not releasing the patent. So I understand there's 12 companies out there right now that are looking for being able to ramp up production of the vaccine. It's not happening at all. Sean, what can people do, the regular layperson, to not only help whistleblowers who have put everything on the line to tell the truth to the American public, but to also try to stop this cycle of war that just continues on and on, more and more automated, less human interaction, amount of people that are being targeted. I mean, even American citizens have been targeted by these drones. And can we expect that, you know, right now there are Hellfire missiles on the drones. Can we expect lasers from the drones?
I mean, there's already aircrafts right now for like anti-missile defense using lasers. But I would say the issue with that is they take a lot of power and need something, you know, with a pretty, like, something of pretty decent size to carry one of them. I'd be less concerned about that. I would be concerned about swarm robotics. I would be concerned about the fact that, like, drone technology is really accessible now. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to go strap a bomb onto a drone and fly it into something. Like, I mean, there's, of course, paying attention to what's happening at the level of the FAA and equivalent institutions, you know, in different countries and what they're permitting to happen in our airspace. Also paying attention to, like, you know, new developments. That's kind of the thing, is like, you want to be effectively engaged in understanding some of these like weapon systems that are developing. You kind of have to like turn on your sci-fi geek a little bit. I mean, it might help to read some sci-fi, because it's kind of cultural determinism. Like, if you notice how influential Star Trek was on our society, and how one day you get the flip phone and now you have a smartphone that does actually more than the tricorder on Star Trek ever really did. People, like kids and young people, watch this stuff and they want to create it. That applies to dystopia as well. And there's a lot of dystopia out there that's kind of like talked about some of this stuff before. Maybe don't like disregard that stuff as nerdy, the territory of nerdiness, but and then also understanding code as like, code is modern day law in a sense. Like, it governs computers. It's the law of computers. And understanding in that context and kind of, you know, reading the literature about what parameters they're putting on things and like the questions that they're putting around these new weapon systems, or even just like what they're allowing in, you know, general society as far as Facebook, whatever, like read the fine print of it and really understands, you know, what they're extracting, what their business model is, what they're capable of doing, and how that might affect society at large. Because, I mean, of course, if everybody's using this platform, they're getting the news from this platform. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that if you, like, post something that, like, everybody's seeing that post. It's just, it's all targeted based on a filter bubble. And you can rile up one filter bubble against another filter bubble. That's a tremendous amount of power that the, you know, institutions like this have. Once they're kind of experimenting on that level, like, you kind of have to wonder like what they can do in terms of foreign policy as well. Thinking outside of the box, not thinking in terms of like how things worked back in the 1960s, because it's very different now.
It's a completely different paradigm. And all of the complex things that Sean was just talking about, you also need to think about it when you get your kid an internet-connected teddy bear. What exactly is it? What is the data that they're collecting and sending up to that cloud? So it gets to be as maybe something that seems as innocuous as a child's doll or game or what have you that's connected to the cloud, because all of this technology is the same, okay? Like there's no difference between IoT, which is the Internet of Things that they talk about in the civilian world, and what I would call War of Things, which is another kind of internet that's out there. And their IoT just happens to be, you know, perhaps an intercontinental ballistic missile. The technology is the same. And when you put it like that, when you explain it to people like what it really, really is, they start to get nervous, because they should be nervous. We should be paying attention to the vast amounts of data that is not only being collected from us, but being targeted to us. So when you look at these things like QAnon, like when you look at all of these conspiracy theories and all of that, they're being multiplied and propagated by social media platforms whose business model is to get you pissed off to click, because then you're looking at it. And when we pay, like, it's overwhelming as hell. I mean, it is incredibly overwhelming. Where all those kids are going to become, all of those kids, some of them are going to become the officers that make the decisions on which future weapons to finance and support. And every single one of these things has a double-edged sword, right? Because, I mean, they're working on things like human-computer interfaces, which would be really wonderful for those people who are quadriplegic and can't, you know, be on the internet or on the web or whatever, or type or any of those things, right? Wouldn't it be great if they could just think and then something on their computer? Yes, it would be wonderful if they could think, turn on the lights, and the lights went on. But on the flip side of that, that same type of technology could be applied to warship, or like the in Germany right now, the actual technology that they're looking at right now, they're looking at this plane, the FCAS. So that plane is going to be connected to a drone swarm, which is also going to be connected to the Eurodrone. And this isn't happening tomorrow. They're looking at this in 2040 something, right? But this is the trajectory that we're going. And it's really good if people could pay attention and look at what is happening with this type of technology, because it's all out in public.
And speaking of Germany, Lisa, you and Sean have been active in advising people in Germany about weaponizing their drones.
Well, I don't know that we're not consulting. We've had discussions with people in governance, and we've shared our experience. And we've shared some of our knowledge about the drone systems, about the systems themselves. And we've talked about some of the things that we need to pay attention to. For example, the missile technology control regime is the global governance that they're using for drones. That particular thing is great for, I mean, it's good for conventional weapons, but it leaves out the specific differences that these new technologies, these emerging technologies bring to the table. And so as opposed to setting these technologies loose on the world and deploying them before we have some sort of treaties in place or global governance in place, I personally believe would be a huge mistake. I mean, why would we want to talk about that catastrophe that occurs with this emerging technology and then have to have the difficult conversations between nation states of how such a tragedy could happen? I mean, putting baby nukes on these things, it's pretty frightening.
Why don't we hear about other countries' drone programs and China and Russia? Are they not as advanced as the United States, or do they just, their governments don't let their military use the drones against quote-unquote or perceived enemies like the United States does? It's always, the United States is always using the drones to assassinate and target people.
The U.S. and Israel are using them actively, populations, Britain as well.
The UK, yeah.
Right. And as far as, yeah, Turkey as well in the Armenia-Azerbaijan conflict, but also in Kurdistan. Of course, there's the countries that the U.S. has sold weapons to, like Saudi Arabia.
UAE.
And, you know, they're using them in Yemen. As far as China goes, yeah, they've got that kind of down lock and key. Like, you're not going to hear people speaking out against things.
You are going to hear people saying, don't touch Huawei.
Yeah. I mean,
tell us about Huawei.
Yeah. It's, I mean, they work on connectivity.
I just wanted to clarify what Huawei is.
It's a technology company.
Okay.
That we're we are not purchasing at the moment.
There's a big controversy over the 5G. With Huawei and, you know, U.S. 5G, it's okay. Kind of around the world, because ultimately you're talking about who controls the network of, you know, this Internet of Things, or like Lisa was talking about, Internet of Scary Things. You know, I mean, as far as Russia goes, I mean, they're quite advanced with their missiles. As far as drones, like, yeah, I mean, they're not really using them so much. There are cases where they've used them in Chechnya.
We appreciate you guys being here today. Sean Westmoreland and Lisa Ling both were involved with the drone program, both United States Air Force honorably discharged veterans who are whistleblowers. I really appreciate you guys being on.
You rock, Don.
And we hope you enjoyed today's show with whistleblowers Lisa Ling and Sean Westmoreland, both honorably discharged United States Air Force veterans. For more information, you can go to the documentary National Bird by Sonia Kennebec, or the book Hellfire from Paradise Ranch on the Front Lines of Drone Warfare, Yosiba Zalaka. Hey, that's a wrap from the Sacred Feather Studios. Special thanks to Ken Kepler. Until next time, everybody, stay safe, be well, peace, and love.
You have been listening to Friendly Fire, a voice for veterans with Don Kimball, who is himself an Air Force veteran. Friendly Fire is broadcast every Friday at 10 a.m. right here on KURU 89.1 FM, Silver City, New Mexico, and on the web at gmcr.org.